Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Safety and Service Delivery Committee meeting. Before we get started, I'd like to turn the floor over to Metro's Chief Safety Officer, Pat Lavin, for today's safety contact. Mr. Lavin.
Good morning. In the case of an emergency, we're going to egress through the main doors illuminated by an exit sign. We're going to assemble across the street at the lawn of the National Building Museum. There's an AED located by the guard station. Fire extinguishers are strategically placed throughout the building, and the restrooms are past the guard booth on the left. Today's safety contact is winter fire safety. Home fires are more prevalent in winter than any other season. As one example, winter storms can interrupt electrical service and cause people to turn to alternative heating sources, which also contributes to the increased risk of fire in the winter. The following video can help you maintain a fire-safe home this winter season.
This message brought to you by FEMA. Home fires occur most often in winter. Keep anything that can catch fire at least 3 feet from heating equipment, and never use an oven to heat your home. Stay in the kitchen when frying, grilling, or broiling food. Turn space heaters off when you leave the room or go to bed. Make sure all vents are clear of snow and ice to allow carbon monoxide to vent outside. Have your furnace, heating system, and chimneys serviced each year by a qualified professional. Learn more at www.usfa.fema.gov.
Thank you, Mr. Lavin. We have a couple of items, administrative items, to take care of. First of all, I need approval of the agenda. Does anybody have any suggested changes to the agenda? Seeing none, the agenda is approved as presented. Next is the approval of the minutes from our previous meeting, which took place January 11, 2018. I'd like to ask a motion from a committee member to approve the minutes of our January 11th session.
So moved.
Can I have a second?
Second.
All in favor? Aye. Thank you. The minutes are approved as presented. Now that we've addressed the committee's administrative business, I'd like to turn it over to our chairman, Mr. Jack Evans, to recognize a special guest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Metro Safety Board Safety Committee meeting. And I'd like to take this opportunity to recognize one of our members of Congress, Representative Barbara Comstock, has joined us today. And Congresswoman, thank you very much for being with us, and thank you for all your support of Metro over the years, and we appreciate everything you've been doing. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll turn to the business of the day, which is for the board to be briefed on some of the preliminary findings of the January 15th Red Line derailment. And as we've discussed, this derailment is still under investigation. We don't expect to have all the details, but certainly we have questions that we'd like to ask staff in relation to this investigation. I want to recognize the cooperative work of the D.C. Fire Department and our own team in safely evacuating all the passengers, which is always our primary concern, so thank you for that. While the team continues its investigation of the root cause of the incident, this meeting was scheduled to provide an update on the preliminary findings and actions that management has taken to date. Of course, we are all focused on knowing as much as we can in order to prevent similar incidents in the future. Before we continue with the presentation and discussion of the WMATA Red Line derailment, I want to make my role as chairman of the Safety and Service Delivery Committee and a DOT-appointed board member perfectly clear. Although I am appointed to the WMATA board as a representative of the Secretary of Transportation, I do not in any way represent the Federal Transit Administration in these proceedings. The FTA has full independent authority for safety oversight of the WMATA system, and as such, any questions I ask or any opinions that I may pose are only my own. So with that, I want to turn it over to Mr. Lavin to give us an overview of the events before the committee begins its discussion and questions. Mr. Lavin.
Thank you. Next slide. So the agenda today is going to cover common causes of rail defects, broken rail detection, a track diagram of the incident area, an executive summary, a timeline of events, our preliminary findings, and the next steps going forward. So some common causes of rail defects, one is base corrosion of the rail, which is essentially electrolysis due to water eating away at the base of the rail. Rail surface defects, which can cause cracks in the head of the rail that eventually can escalate to a rail break. Rail wear, where a rail is worn beyond its tolerance. fastener deterioration in the course of the support of a rail, where you get deflection of the rail, where eventually the rail will start developing cracks, track geometry defects such as cross-level engage, and extreme weather conditions where you get dramatic swings in temperature. So far, none of those have been deemed as a causal factor in this event, and as Mr. Lobby stressed, this incident is under investigation. So the next feature is how a broken rail is detected. The first method is through ultrasonic testing, and the best example I can give you for that is if you visualize a pregnant female receiving a sonogram, where you can see internally what is going on. The ultrasonic testing essentially performs an x-ray of the rail. We shoot waves into the rail, we get that feedback. Any anomalies in there are then detected, and that would then generate a response like the changing of the rail proactively. Next is track walker inspections. These are performed twice weekly, where you have boots on the ground looking at the local conditions of the rail as well as the environment surrounding it. Next is disruptions to signal systems. We are fortunate to have a system where both rails are looked at. If one of those rails break, it'll disrupt the AC energy running to the track relay. You'll either get a bobbing circuit or you'll get a down track relay. If we have one of those conditions, it invokes a speed restriction of the train, and we immediately dispatch people to investigate. Okay, the next is the track diagram of the incident layout. So essentially, it happened between Farragut North and Metro Center and in direction towards Glenmont. I'm going to queue up a video that's approximately 2 minutes long. Ryan, you can actually put it up and start playing it. So just to orientate you, this is the incident train pulling into Farragut North. And I'll walk you through what you're seeing. So essentially, the train is now making a station stop. It's servicing station. I'd like to point out a couple features in this video. You can see that the track is clean. The tunnel lighting is illuminated. Momentarily, you'll see the train pull out. I want to focus your attention to the rail on the left side of the screen. As we get further into the video, that is the rail that broke on that side. The video demonstrates to some degree that the rail appeared to have been intact, so we would not have had some type of forewarning like the signal system kicking off prior to this derailment. So now the train is leaving the station, and approximately another minute or so, you'll see the train come to rest. That is the actual derailment occurring. The train stops, and then you'll see what is a cloud of smoke go past the front of the train, which we've determined to be, with fairly good certainty, be pulverized concrete from the train scraping against the side of the bench wall and knocking off a skin coating of shotcrete. Train is now derailed and is coming to rest. You'll see the cloud of smoke go past the front of the train momentarily. And I'd also like to point out on the right side of the screen, you'll see those hangers on the wall. That is the snake tray or the cable tray for the new radio project that's underway. Okay, so I'm going to go through. You can go to the next slide, Ryan. I'm going to go through an executive summary of what occurred, and then that executive summary will be followed by four additional videos that show some of the evacuation and some of the other events that occurred. At approximately 6:26 hours on Monday, January 15th, the Glenmont-bound Red Train ID 106 traveling at approximately 37 miles an hour derailed due to a broken rail at chain marker A1-028+20. The incident occurred on track one, approximately 1,000 feet south of Farragut North Station, while traveling on an unguarded curve with 4 inches of super elevation. At the time of the incident, train ID 106 had just serviced the Farragut North Station and was on approach to Metro Center. At 6:28, the train operator board train ID 106 reported to the Rail Operations Control Center that the train had experienced an emergency brake application and smoke was coming into the cab. It is most probable that much of the smoke that was generated was a result of soundproofing material coating that was affixed to the side of the bench while being pulverized as the car bodies of the derailed car scraped against it during the event, which produced clouds of dust. Fan operation was functional as observed by WMATA personnel on site, and I'll get more into the fan operation in detail as part of the presentation. At 6:46, an MTPD officer reported to the ROC that the train appeared to have been derailed. The MTPD officer was designated as the incident commander until the arrival of the DCFD. The officer walked through the train cars to verify that no customers aboard the train were in need of medical assistance. During post-incident response activities, it was identified that a total of 6 axles on the trucks associated with the 5th, 6th, and 7th cars had derailed. The incident vehicle traveled in a derailed state for approximately 796 feet, with the forwardmost derailed axle coming to rest at A120+24. WMATA personnel and DCFD responded to the scene. A unified command post was established at Metro Center at the platform level. The regional fire liaison at the ROC was also engaged with the incident since its initial report of smoke. As part of the coordinated evacuation operation, the contact rail was de-energized at 6:48 hours on both tracks, and power was verified off by WMATA personnel with a hot stick. Additionally, a WSAD, a warning strobe alarm device that detects the presence of third rail energy, were set up along the roadway, and 63 individuals consisting of 60 customers and 3 employees were evacuated from the lead car to the roadway and safely escorted approximately 1,700 feet to the Metro North Station platform via Track 1 by MTPD, Office of Emergency Management, Rail Transportation, and responding DCFD personnel. The tunnel environment used as the evacuation route was properly illuminated and free of obstacles. The time from the report of the derailment to the completion of the evacuation was 1 hour and 38 minutes. There were no injuries reported as a result of this incident. WMATA safety personnel responded to the scene and commenced with investigative activities. An 8-foot section of rail was found to be fractured and was determined to be the point of derailment. A crack at the base of the rail appeared to show signs of oxidation, which suggests that the integrity of the rail was compromised prior to the rail fully fracturing during the incident. This section of rail was removed, quarantined, and sent for metallurgical testing to aid in identifying the root cause of the derailment. A final determination on the root cause or contributing factors in this incident has not been made. However, the fractured rail obviously played a significant role in the event. At 10:30 a.m. on January 16, 2018, normal service was resumed. The public radio system utilized by the DCFD was working as designed. WMATA's internal radio was intermittent in the immediate location of derailment, was fully operational 300 feet from the location and on the adjacent track. It should be noted that the car-borne radio performed better than the handheld radios. The investigation of this incident is ongoing. So what I'd like to show now is 4 additional videos. The first video you're going to see, and I'll tell you when to play it, Ryan, is going to show the operator cab. I think there's some speculation of how did the train operator not know that the train was derailed. This is a view from the back of the train looking towards the train operator's compartment. You'll notice in the left-hand top of the screen there's an individual reading a newspaper. I point that out because have you not seen that motion on the train, you may think this is a still shot. So this is, and in the corner of that picture, there's a picture-in-picture that shows you where the train is in relationship to the derailment. So you'll see the outside view simultaneously with the head card of the train in motion. So you can play that, Ryan. You'll see the train coming to rest. The train is derailed at this point. So there's really no indication in the head car that that train was derailed. So to illustrate this a little better, I'm going to show you what happened in the 4th and 5th cars that were truly experienced the most dramatic part of the derailment. Ryan, you can cue that up. And this is a view. I'm sorry, just pause it for 1 second. I just want you to start off and just pause it. So within the first 3 seconds, you're going to see the train lurch. So I just want you to be conscious of what you're looking for. This is a view of the 4th car into the 5th car. I'll mention it. So when the, I just want to point something out. The blurriness is intentional. We pixelated the faces of the passengers. Does anybody want to see this again? Or, all right, Bob would like to see it again.
And I guess we look through the window to see what's happening on the
road. In the fifth car, you see it go dark, which I'll explain later.
Moving back and forth.
Right. Yes. You'll see it within the first 3 seconds, that car lurching as well. That bump. That's the car hitting, going up and down as the rail collapse was broken beneath it. Right, right. That's the axles coming off the rail. Okay, so the next video, and we're not trying to minimize the seriousness of this, but we just want to show you some of the evacuations. We feel that went very well, which is why we did not have any injuries. So, Brian, if you can cue up the next video, this is the passengers being led off the front of the train. And once again, I'll point out that the tunnel lighting was lit, there was no apparent obstacles in the track, other than down the road you'd see like an ATC call, you'd have to step over a piece of wire. So in my opinion, it appears to be a calm, controlled evacuation. I believe it was 1,700 feet to the station. And that was actually closer than going through Farragut North. All right, and the next video is just a picture of the passengers arriving at the station. The key takeaway from this is they all have glow sticks, so there was safety equipment available on the train as required. And once again, there's first responders at the station to direct them. They generally strategically place them. If there's an individual, whether they're elderly or some or disabled, then somebody would assist them. Okay, so Brian, you go to the next slide. It's the timeline of events. So I just want to walk through this quickly because there's a lot of questions about how this played out. So at 6:25, the train leaves Farragut North Station. At 6:26, there's a derailment in progress. And the reason we come up with 6:26 is there was a breaker activation momentarily in the rock, which we attribute to the one of the current collectors on the train being damaged. That most probably is what caused that breaker to trip. Once that was, you know, disengaged from the third rail, the breaker restored. The next is at 6:28 is the contact with the rock from the train operator notifying that the train is brakes in emergency and that there's smoke. At that point, the rock controller starts to engage with the train operator. I think the primary focus at that point, it was being treated as a mechanical failure. Because there are certain failures where you can get a stuck brake, where you can generate smoke. It was not being treated as a derailment at that moment. But it's also key to know that the regional fire liaison at the rock was aware of it at the time that this was occurring, so he was, from the inception, he was aware of what was occurring. He was also viewing it at that moment as some degree of a mechanical failure, although there was a report of smoke. At 6:29, the tunnel fans are activated. That's an approximate. The actual time is 6:28:57, so we just rounded up to 6:29, which is when you have a report of smoke, you turn the fans on. What the information I have right now is that all the fans work. They were fit on exhaust. One of the fans went into an alarm because it didn't detect air movement, but the fan was actually operational. So it was an indication, not an operational problem. The next is at 6:35, WMATA called the DCFD directly via 911 to alert them of the situation as they couldn't overcome the mechanical failure. At 6:42, DCFD arrived at Farragut North Station. I want to point out that the strategy that we learned as part of the hot wash is that when DCFD responds to this, they also deploy a recon team to the adjacent station, so they essentially sandwich the train. So resources from FD went to Farragut North as well as Metro Center. At 6:46, the MTPD officer had identified that the train was derailed. He then went off the front of the train, walked approximately 300 feet, and via his handheld radio was able to communicate to the rock to notify them that there was indeed a derailment. I just want to point out, as part of what we're assessing, is it appears that The car-borne radio on the train worked much better than the handhelds, and what we believed was something, you know, possibly could be contributing to this is the placement of the antenna within the car gives you a better opportunity to communicate if you have low amplification, which I'll get to in the radio section. Okay, it's from 648 to 802, passenger safety assurance activity was being conducted. So this is where the greatest time was consumed with the evacuation process. So as the situation is developing, you're making real-time decisions on how to get those passengers off the train. So one of the things that we considered was the use of a rescue train to bring that train in, stage them at a medical, Metro Center, and then use that train as a rescue train. So as the situation was evolving, the DCFD arrived on the scene. They physically walked out to the train. They were on board the train. All the passengers at this point were in the first car. No one was in distress. Everybody seemed comfortable because you had first responders on the scene. At that point, with the decision being that we were going to use a rescue train because an inspection of the third rail did not identify any defects, we were contemplating restoring third rail power using a rescue train. But as this situation was evolving, we kept identifying additional axles that were derailed on the vehicles. At that point, we abandoned that idea because we were afraid that the restoration of power may introduce a hazard by the restoration of power because we did not know what was compromised on the undercar components of that train. So at that point, the FT had already exited the tracks so that we could do the power restoration. And then we had to redeploy them again back onto the tracks when that idea was abandoned. That consumed approximately 30 minutes. So one of the things that we identified, and we did a hot wash Monday with DC Fire, DC Police Department, and all the internal stakeholders, is that in a situation, and this is not an absolute 100% concrete, but one of the first considerations in an incident where a train is immobilized is to abandon the idea of a rescue train and go to a ground evacuation more swiftly. So that's kind of one of the key lessons learned from this. All right, I'd like to say that's not 100% absolute because you could have different circumstances that would drive a different response. All right, at 8:02, a controlled evacuation from the lead car commenced. That's what you saw in the video. At 8:24, all customers were reported clear of the roadway. At 8:53, DCFD turned the scene over to Metro for restoration and investigative activities. Findings? I'm sorry.
Mr. Lavin, the response times from 6:28 to, say, 6:48, 7 o'clock, are those acceptable? Are those within the norm of what you expect for responses and communication going back and forth between the various bodies?
Yeah, I'm still evaluating because obviously we have to look at the procedures. What is the detail of each procedure? How will they follow? That's still part of the analysis. But I just want to point that at 6:28, this was being treated as a mechanical failure. It wasn't until 6:46 when it was identified as a derailment that it became a much higher level escalated event. So we are analyzing all the responses and how they played out.
If I could just follow up briefly on that.
Sure. Well, at that point, the rock controller was speaking directly to the train operator. There's certain activities that have to occur on the ground as well, like they have to shut off the EB system to make sure the smoke doesn't penetrate the cars. They're trying to collect the information, so 7 minutes was consumed in that activity. And the other piece of this is, although the radio communication was better from the car-borne piece, there were still transmissions that had to be repeated back and forth.
I just would like to add, just to confirm everybody, there was no report of fire. Okay, all right. So, and if you remember the video, okay, when the train was coming to a stop, there's no movement. So what the train operator is seeing in real time is he's got a brakes and emergency. When you have a brakes and emergency, a lot of things can happen. If you have a brake pipe rupture, okay, your compressors are still working, it's pushing out air, that can create a plume slow. So I think at that time, the train operator did not know he was derailed and just thought he had a recent emergency. So I just want to make sure that's clear. There was no fire. And a lot of times, a train operator that's experienced a recent emergency would probably realize that plume of smoke coming through could be just dust and everything that's on the train.
So let's give staff a chance to meet the rest of the presentation, and then we're going to go around, and we'll have plenty of time for questions. But I want to make sure we get the rest of the story on the record here.
All right, so the next is going to be findings. We're going to discuss system communications, evacuation, life safety, track inspection and testing, tracking structures, human factors, vehicles, and quality assurance. As part of the investigation, we'll also be looking at the training records. That has not happened yet. All right, and this is by no means a conclusive final analysis of what occurred. This is a preliminary approximately 1 week after the event. So from system communications, we found there was poor CRS radio communication in the area. So post-incident, they went out and they identified an uplink issue, which means there's an amplifier that transmits the signal from the field back to the rail control center. They had to readjust that, and they attributed it to the age of the system. That antenna, they eventually degrade, and as they degrade, then you have to increase the amplification to put it back into tolerance. That was what was found on track one for that specific area. So it was essentially an antenna problem. So we looked at the CRCS inspection process. They do an annual PMI for signal amplification. That occurred March 27, 2017. They do an annual PMI or preventive maintenance inspection. For the feeder amplifier, that was done October 3rd, 2017. And they did a downlink scan, which confirms the signal strength from the rail control center to the trains. That occurred on December 6, 2017. For the PRS system, that worked as designed. That was last tested by DC Fire on January 5th and 12th of 2018. So what we found as part of the investigation is they have a OAP, or an Organizational Administrative Procedure, which is 105.3. In the OAP, it requires a weekly uplink and downlink scan of the system, as well as an analysis of the data that's captured during those scans. So we found that although the requirement was for them to do this test weekly, they had deviated and had set up a biweekly schedule, and we found in some instances that test was occurring on a monthly basis rather than even the biweekly. In addition to that, they were only doing the downlink scans. They were not doing the uplink scans. They were relying some degree on the internal users reporting problems, because there's roughly 42,000 transmissions per day in the metro system. So therefore, they were relying on a large degree on the end user telling them uplink problems, and they were also relying on the testing that was done by the DC Fire Department. When myself and Mr. Leader became aware of that, we started an immediate scan of the entire system to do the uplink and downlink check. We've gotten back the internal scans for the uplink and downlink. Right now in the right-of-way, there are zero radio issues in the entire system for the internal piece. We have one issue, and that's at a kiosk level, so it's not down on the roadway where the trains run. That is the only issue internally that we're aware of and that we're addressing based on the scan. The public radio address system, both of the uplink and downlink scans have been completed. They're still doing an analysis of the data. To our knowledge, there are zero public radio system problems throughout the entire system. All right, and just for situational awareness, when we do identify a public radio system problem, that goes into Maximo, which is our database. When the Maximo data information is populated, that then goes to a ROD map, and that ROD map then shows you where that outage is so that a select group of people have that information as needed. In addition to that, we took the train operator's radio. That is in the proper calibration date, which is July 12th of 2019 is the next time it's due. We also sent that radio for testing. In addition to this, that's not on the slide, I also requested that the MTPD officer's radio also be bench tested just to verify there's no defects. We checked the ETS phones or the emergency phones in the area, so if you have an issue communicating on a radio, by protocol, the train operator is required to go to the ETS phones, use those for communication. They were checked prior to the event, and they were checked post-incident. They were all working as designed. So the immediate actions are, they corrected the CRCS uplink issue in the incident area, and as I stated previously, we did a system-wide sweep of both the public and internal radio system. The next is the evacuation fire life safety. From the best we can tell, and this is also part of the hot wash, I asked the DC Fire Department directly when you got there, the did you detect smoke? And they said, no, there was no smoke. And as one of the individuals walking out from Metro Center, he confirmed that he kept repeating back to his command, there's no smoke, there's no smoke. So that initial plume we believe to be the concrete dust that was pulverized from being on a wall. As I stated earlier, the tunnel lighting was illuminated. The evacuation path was free of obstructions. There was no injuries reported. And although I'm sensitive to the amount of time that was consumed here, I believe that we did the safest course of action, which was to protect the riding public, and I think that's demonstrated by having no injuries in this event. And yes, there are areas we can improve on with that. The tunnel fans were working. We also requested plant engineering do a complete analysis of it so we could determine why that indication was illuminated, what that fault was. But it did not affect the operation of the fan. And in addition to that, as I stated earlier, we did a hot wash on Monday to try to do lessons learned from this event. I feel that was a productive meeting. One of my takeaways from that meeting is DC Fire expressed that over the last few years that the relationship and the practices between Metro and the external agencies has gotten a lot better. Next, we come to track inspection and testing. So there were track walker inspections done, which is a twice weekly activity. They were last performed the 3rd, the 7th, the 10th of 2018. I reviewed those actual forms. There was no restrictable conditions identified in that area. There were minor defects, but nothing that would be rise to the level of a restrictable speed condition. All right, track geometry testing is done twice yearly. The last test was done October 2nd, 2017. I want to point out that we do the test internally with our own equipment, and our certified inspectors review that data. So one of the things I wanted to do from a safety assurance level is I had that data sent down to an independent third party. They reviewed the August, We did the track geometry testing. There was no anomalies. With the ultrasonic testing, that was run on August 9th. What we did from a safety assurance perspective, because it's the ultrasonic testing that tells you the condition of the rail, we took the August 9th data. We sent that out to an independent party. They did an analysis of the August 9th data. They found that we had interpreted the data correctly and that there were no defects. I just want to point out from an industry standard, Metro exceeds what is typically done in the industry. The FRA has a once annual inspection, with the caveat being that if you have a high ratio of broken rails in a certain segment of track, that'll drive additional inspections. The APTA recommends that it's done once yearly. The FTA does not have a regulatory requirement. All right, we're going to move on to rail grinding. Rail grinding, for those of you who do not know, is the surface of the rail can start getting cracks on the edges. Those can propagate into a greater defect and a rail break. We have a rail grinding program which resurfaces that rail to bring it back to a smooth surface. So last year we did 136 miles of rail grinding, which is roughly 50% of the system. All right, in addition, we did a look back for approximately, I think it was 9 years and change, which is all the data we have. There was no rail breaks in that area. And lastly, I just want to emphasize that this area was not part of the SafeTrack activities. There's some speculation that SafeTrack would have fixed this. This was not a SafeTrack area, and I believe we all recognize that SafeTrack was never envisioned to cure all the agency's issues. For track instructions, I want to point out that we don't believe the rail was compromised prior to the train going over it. If you look at the video, which we showed earlier, the 7K, it appears that the rail was intact. In addition to that, I had ATC personnel go out to the train control room in the area. They downloaded the event recorded data from that room. There's no indication of any track circuit phase or bobbing track circuits, which would be consistent with a broken rail. So therefore, we believe the rail was intact when the train went over it. Further, as part of post-incident inspections of the cars, the first two cars, the wheels of those cars are clean. From the third car back, you can see physical flange damage, which indicates on the third and fourth floor car of that train, the rail was starting to fracture under the train as it was traversing it. When you got to the fifth car, the rail was in such a compromised state that the fifth, sixth, and seventh cars, varying axles, derailed on it. The eighth car actually derailed and then re-railed. So the rail was manufactured in 1993. So I want to point out rail is basically changed based on rail wear. And in curves in different areas, you can get rail wear at different rates. From what we saw on that rail, there's no indication that that rail was worn to a point where it should have been changed. And just as anecdotally, if a rail is in the right environment and it's maintained the right way with the right infrastructure, a rail can last as long as 50 years. The crack that we observed on the scene appeared to be present in the base of the rail, and it had signs of oxidation. So if you see oxidation, it's basically a rust color within the crack of the rail, which means that it was present, and then it propagated rather quickly, because if you see other pictures and you see silver on top of it, that means that's a rapid fracture that occurred, where oxidation means that the crack could have been existing. The question is could that crack have been identified by a track walker, or was it present during the ultrasonic? And best we can tell with the ultrasonic, it was not detected if it was there, but I want to point out that ultrasonic testing is not 100% foolproof. It does not penetrate to the base of the rail, to the outer edges. So, from the environmental standpoint, the track conditions were dry. I didn't see any evidence of any kind of electrolysis or base erosion, and the weather is under evaluation. There, I believe we looked at the NOAA website for the weather the 7 days leading up to the event. The day prior to it, there was an approximately 40-degree swing in the temperature. However, I don't know how much that influenced this in a tunnel environment. I could tell you on the day of the event, it was extremely cold outside, but when you were underground at the location, it was probably 20 to 30 degrees warmer. Lastly, the rail, as I said earlier, was sent for independent analysis. The individual who's doing the analysis is a fellow by the name of Dan Stone. He's affiliated with TTCI as well as the AAR. So he's an extremely knowledgeable railroad person, so we have a high confidence level that we'll get a good report back from him. I can't give you an ETA on when that report will arrive at this time. So from human factors, the train was traveling at approximately 37 miles an hour. The required speed for that area was 35. The train operator was sent for post-incident testing. The results are negative. From a fatigue analysis standpoint, we did both the train operator and the rock controller. There's no significant risk of fatigue based on their schedules. All right, and once again, we're going to be looking at their training certification, their previous history, all of those activities which not have occurred yet, but they're in the process. From a vehicle standpoint, all the rail vehicles involved were complying with the preventive maintenance cycles. From a rail car damage standpoint, you had side impact damage from the vehicle scraping against the bench wall. And just anecdotally, during post-incident activities, we had the bench walls re-inspected to verify there was no structural issues with the bench walls from this impact. There was damage to the trucks. There was damage to the brake rotors and the gearboxes. And we have an engineering analysis occurring with damage course pending. Part of the engineering analysis will be items where we're looking at, if you saw in the video, when you're looking into the fourth car, into the fifth car, that car went dark. So part of the analysis will be, why didn't the emergency lighting work in that car? What was there opportunities for the PA to work on all eight cars and factors such as that, how the cars performed in this type of event? From a quality assurance standpoint, prior to this incident, QCO was scheduled on January 23rd to do this. That schedule was set up prior to this event. I think, you know, we've gotten a lot of positive feedback from internal users as far as QCO audits. I believe they did 18 last year, and all of those were posted public for transparency purposes. So QCO kicked off on January 23rd, an internal audit of the communication group. That, I want to emphasize, was not a reaction to this. That was already previously scheduled to occur. In addition to that, there's 21 FDA communication caps. 10 of those have been closed, 2 are under review, and 9 are in development. The next steps, we're awaiting the results of the independent broken rail analysis. Once we have that, that'll give us more insight of what the root cause of the incident was, and then based on that, that'll drive our corrective action plans and how to address this going forward in the future. In addition to that, we're conducting an internal broken rail trend analysis. This is a working group that's going to be consist of SAFE, track engineering, and track maintenance to identify causal factors in these. You know, what procedures need to get changed, what frequency of testing, all of those types of things, so we can come up with common denominators and increase the opportunity to prevent broken rails from occurring in the future. In addition to that, we're evaluating the current automatic track testing frequencies, which I'll discuss in the next step slide, a couple slides up. We're also evaluating the OAP policy and resources. So one of the things that we're going to do, or we have already done, as I stated earlier, we did a system-wide sweep of the system. We're going to set up a contract to bring in a third party to do the weekly tests and also provide the engineering support to ensure that we're consistent with the compliance that we state we're doing in the OAP. And then we'll also, with the OAP, there, we identified that the internal policy, although the OAP addressed pretty well the public piece of this, we also want to make that cover the internal radio testing as well, so we ensure that we have good policies covering both systems. All right, the last thing on this slide I want to mention is the radio project. So I've received an update. So basically with the radio project, that'll give us certain upgrades and better features to the radio system, one of those being a self-diagnostic capability. So if a component starts to fail, it'll alert us. It'll improve our opportunities to identify defects in the system. The cellular service, I believe, will be available by 2020, and the complete coverage, we're estimating fall of 2022. So some of the things that we're considering, and I want to mention that a lot of these actions were already through procurement, and we're bringing them on board. So with the frequency of the ultrasonic testing, we're going to move from 2 times a year to 3 times a year, and one of those will be done by a third-party vendor. So we'll do it twice internally and then once with a third party for some level of safety assurance. The next three items are things that we already started in procurement that we're hoping to have in 2018. So one is tie imaging scanning, which tells you the conditions of the tie. The next is rail boat-based corrosion scanning. And the last is lateral load testing, which induces the load of a train onto the rails for measuring, because when you test with a TGV vehicle, it does not have the same weight as a rail car. So when you do the lateral load testing, it'll give you a true measure as if it was a rail car on the rails pushing outward, to verify the geometry of the cars, of the tracks. So one of the other things we're considering is high definition scanning. So essentially what this does is it gives you a few benefits. One, it allows you to scan at high speed on a track at 60 miles an hour. It gives you a historical archive of what was out there. This way, as you do each run, you can compare the run over run to see if conditions are degrading. It also gives you, to some degree, a high-resolution picture, which you can now, as you're interpreting this data, freeze it, go back, review it. So if you see anomalies, it enhances your ability and opportunities to identify rail defects. This technology was subject to an FDA study, and the report number is on the screen as 0049. And this is being used at other properties, or is being piloted at other properties. So at this time, I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lavin. Very comprehensive report. I congratulate you on that. We're going to have questions from the committee members first, and then we'll go to the other board members. So if everybody be patient, we will have a chance for you to ask your questions. I've been in contact with Mr. Lavin and the safety team the last couple of weeks, just talking about different issues here. Some issues related to the broken rail, some issues related to the response to the incident, and some issues related to the evacuation of the train. And I've gotten very good response that these issues are being addressed, and a lot of them showed up in this presentation today. So I'm very confident that we're going to get to the bottom of this. It's too bad that we had this broken rail accident. In my experience at FRA, broken rail accidents are the number one cause of derailments on mainline railroads in this country. We have processes in place to try to detect whatever we can, and it's not always possible to find everything, but I'm sure that with your investigation you'll be able to identify some things maybe we can do better to try to limit the risk of broken rails in the future. With that said, would you tell me a little bit more about the hot wash process? Who participates in that? Do you talk about things that went wrong, or do you talk about things that went right? And who participates in that?
So generally, you want to have all the stakeholders in the region. In this area, it happened to be DC Fire, so they were present. So you had high-level leadership from DC Fire there, as well as the ROC liaison, because we want to make sure that that communication exists and it's done properly. The primary focus is twofold. What went right? What went wrong? It's a free-flowing, open discussion where all the concerns are raised. And it really is, the goal of that is the takeaway is what can we do going forward, regardless of what went right or what went wrong, what can we do going forward to improve the process or to better incident command or whatever the issue at hand is.
Did you have any specific comments from the emergency responders on things to do differently or issues that they had?
Yeah, one of the key findings that I think that came out of that is that we as an organization have a tendency not to want to pit passengers to the roadbed, so we always take the approach of using a rescue train, or that's one of the first things in our forward most thinking. In a situation where a train is immobilized, that may not be the best approach. So the best approach would probably be to remove power, pit the passengers on the right of way once you have a sufficient number of first responders there to safely evacuate them, and that would have shaved off probably at least 30 minutes off of this incident.
And you're making those changes in your standard operating procedures?
Yes, we're looking at that, and we're looking at the overall procedure for evacuation because there's other elements of it that I want to look at that I don't think are necessarily the best approach we should be taking.
All right. I want to make sure everybody has a chance to ask their questions, so I'll go over to Ms. Harley.
Thank you so much. That was a very complete presentation. I just have some process questions. Number one being, you mentioned that there were other additional Metro employees on the train. Were they on duty or were they passengers?
So you had three Metro employees on the train. One was the MTBD officer was on duty. You had the train operator was on duty, and you had an off-duty train operator.
Okay. And in situations like that, are train operators and or any other Metro employees that might be on the train, What is their training, perhaps, to assist in evacuations? Is there any level of that they are familiar with to assist passengers?
As part of the training, I have to verify what's actually in the curriculum. They should be getting evacuation training. More importantly, they're all trained on NIMS. So I believe the National Incident Management System, they're all trained on NIMS. I got a query yesterday, and I believe the population of train operators are trained right now is 95%. So it's part of our strategies to make sure they're trained on incident command and how to handle an emergency.
And you mentioned in one of the slides that Metro contacted 911 directly. Who is responsible for that in Metro?
That was done by the ROC controller.
So the ROC contacted. Was that based off of the conversation with the train operator or the police officer?
I would have to explore that further. I believe it was probably because of the report of the train being disabled, the report of smoke, and them not being able to overcome the condition.
And the police officer that reported the derailment, did he report it after exiting the train?
Yes, he had to. He couldn't communicate with his handheld radio. So he was actually in the eighth car of the train. He walked through the entire train. He was rounding up the passengers, moving them forward. When he got to the head car, he couldn't transmit properly. It was coming in garbled. He got off the train, walked approximately 300 feet, and was able to transmit via his handheld.
In a situation where the Metro train operator is the only employee on the train, who would be responsible for evaluating that? Would he have stayed on the train until someone came to the scene to evaluate?
The train operator aboard the train procedurally, if he's the only person, would become the incident commander. And then they would have to take whatever actions necessary they felt to safeguard service and the passengers.
Did any of the passengers that were on the train report being able to utilize their phones?
I did not ask that question. I know I was down there and I had cell service. There was someone next to me, another employee, who had a different carrier. They weren't able to have cell service.
Okay, that's all I have now. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Levin, thank you for this thorough presentation. You talked a little bit about the analysis that's ongoing. Can you give us a better sense of what that will include and what the general expected time frame might be?
Sure. So when we do an analysis of a derailment or any event, we treat it as we look at every single department from what occurred, what their training is, what their policy is, what their conformance to the policy is. So basically an investigation is an intense audit of each department. So that's the approach we take. I can't give you a definitive timeline, but in general terms, it usually takes about 90 days to get a comprehensive investigation accomplished. There can still be outliers such as engineering issues or other things that may warrant additional analysis and recommendations going forward for future designs, but that's in general terms.
I will ask this one. I wanted to ask, in terms of, as you go through this evaluation and the relationship with the rock coordination piece and those others, does this all feed back to them in a manner such that they take advantage of anything that we find?
Yeah, that'll be one component of it, the rock activities and how this plays out organizationally. But just so everyone's aware, when we become aware of a problem, we're not waiting to the end of the investigation. As I mentioned earlier, when myself and Mr. Alito recognized that we were not conforming with the radio testing, that was acted on immediately, and we did a sweep of the entire system. So whatever deficiencies we identify, we'll be addressing in real time.
Thank you. Let's go over here.
Thank you, Pat, for a very thorough analysis. I think it's slide number 25. There was a chart there that showed the broken rails over 5 years, 6 years, or whatever. If we could take a look at that, there was a major decline in 2017. What do those numbers tell us? We were better at finding them before they broke, or that?
Well,
there you go on this one.
Yeah,
or were we not as good at finding them?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things. Okay, I think it's you have more diligent attention to task as far as making sure that those tests are done in compliance. One of the key things that I want to mention is that on the SafeTrack, the primary focus of SafeTrack was ties. So we reduced the number of bad ties in the system from like 22% down to 2%. And as I mentioned in one of the earlier slides, one of the causes of broken rails is poor support. So if you get a lot of bad ties and pumping, that can lead to broken rails. When you renew the system in that type of fashion, you improve the substructure, therefore you could get a decline in broken rails. I'm not saying it was all safe track, but that could be one of the things that had a major influence.
So on these here, if you give us a couple of, for instances, how were these found? Was it certainly was not always a derailment.
Correct.
Were we just lucky?
No, I'll give you a concrete example. Two nights ago, the ultrasonic call went out. As they were doing it, they picked up a floor, and we have a floor in the rail. We have a chase vehicle behind it, so the scan came back as a 10% possible rail defect, which means, and Joe can speak on what that 10% means, but it did pick up an anomaly in the rail. The chase vehicle immediately replaced that rail behind the train. We put in a 39-foot section of rail, and that's how a lot of these are identified. So in 2017, I think we had 13 actual broken rails, and four of those we identified through UT testing, so we would have 17. So they were basically replaced before they failed. And in addition to that, we've had instances where you've had down track circuits, signal personnel or EOT has responded, and we found broken rails.
Okay, so when it's fixed before it actually breaks, that's not considered a broken rail then?
Right, that's considered an internal flaw.
Okay. So it seems like we've gotten better at that, if these numbers are indicative.
Right, and it's also maintaining the system, doing those activities.
Thank you.
Pat, I just want to go back to the timeline and reference, I guess, page 15, the timeline of events. At 6:28, it says that the train 106 contacted the ROCC. So there was communication between the train operator and the ROCC at that point in time?
I'm sorry, you're talking 6:46?
No, this is 6:28 a.m. Train 106 contacts the ROC.
Yes, so what I mentioned in the presentation is that what we believe is that the carborne radio, where he was communicating from at the time, was giving off a better signal to the ROC, because what we're attributing to, and this is not confirmed, is we believe that the radio antenna on the train was better situated than where the handhelds were. So when he was communicating from the cab, we seemed to be getting a better product.
Okay, so he was communicating from the cab.
Right.
And
the call when,
on when
radio
was there a detection that he was in a dead zone, that the communication had failed, or was not as good when he started leaving the cab and going down to other cars on the train?
Well, I think it was twofold. You also had the MTPD officer couldn't get through. So they recognized there was a communication problem. You also had the ROC saying to them, come in and repeat the message. So there was some indication that they weren't getting proper communication.
So why did the person on the scene that was in charge shift from the train operator to the police officer if both had the handheld that allowed them to be in communication with the ROC?
Okay, so that responsibility never shifted because the train operator was not alone on the train. The initial incident commander on that was the MTPD officer, which he was directed by the ROC to be the incident commander. The next shift in incident command was when DC Fire arrived and set up the command post. That was relinquished to DC Command, and then the third handover was from DC Fire to Metro.
I think you have to realize in the first few minutes of an incident, I don't even know if the train operator realized it was an MTPD officer in the eighth car. So when he realized it's an incident, eventually when the train operator left his cab, the MTPD officer is walking towards each other. At that time, they left, they're using their portable radios, and that's where the communication issues came into. But I don't think at the time, the train operator realized that there was an MTPD officer on that train.
Now, this issue of dead zones has been a longstanding problem in the system in the tunnels. And I think one of your slides shows that the target date for completion of the revised radio system is fall 2022. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What can be done to either identify the dead zones and correct the problem now or move the resources to the tunnels so that at least the dead zones in the tunnels can be communications can be restored and those deadlines eliminated at an earlier date?
So I think the true solid fix for this is the 2022 radio project. Okay, but the people are aware that there are locations where you have challenges with radio communication. If you're in that area by training, then there are ETS boxes in that area, you would go and use the emergency telephone on the track. And that's how it's being addressed at this time.
I guess what I'm asking you, what's to prevent reordering the resources so that they focus now on the dead zone areas in the tunnel as part of the radio project rather than above ground locations? What's to prevent us from reordering resources so that the dead zones are addressed as a priority?
We can certainly look at it. That may actually be being done. I'm not intimately familiar with what the scope of how they're laying out the work on a radio project is, but I'll certainly bring that to them. And it sounds like a good suggestion.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions?
Can you speak briefly to the video coverage that we saw? So, of the fleet we have, how many of the trains are equipped with that video capability? And then secondly, how accessible is that video, either in real time or is it a go down and actually pull out the hard drive from the vehicle?
Okay, so the only vehicles in the fleet that have the forward-facing camera outside the train are the 7K trains. The 6Ks have cameras as well. Those you'd have to go call up one to download them. Same with the 7Ks. You have to go aboard the train to get the data. So it's really incident-based, or if you wanted to do a fish.
So it's an after-incident diagnostic tool, law enforcement response,
correct,
investigation, that sort of thing. Okay.
Yes.
Do you have something, Mr. Spenper?
Yes, I just wanted to follow up. Mr. Lavin, you mentioned in my question about general response times in regard to the timeline that's presented. You said they would be reviewed or part of the review. Ms. Harley asked a line of questioning that focused on communication and communication in general. Other than communication issues, are there other aspects of a review for response time response times, unacceptable, faster than expected?
Yeah, so what I would say to that is I'd have to do more analysis because there's four streams of data, right? You have the telephone conversations, you have the ambient communications occurring in a room, you have the radio transmissions, and then you have telephone. So what I really need to do is do a transcription of all four mediums and then do a crosswalk of, because you're really looking at them in isolation. You need to look at them together.
Mr. Costa.
Morning, and thank you for the report out, Pat. I have a question about rail-based corrosion scanning. It sounds like it's difficult to do right now, and you have it listed as an a possible text expansion program. Can you talk a little bit about what that might entail?
Okay, so what that essentially is a camera on the bottom of a rail car that scans the rail base, and what it does is it, once you program a certain parameter into it, it looks at the thickness of the rail base, and when it detects deviations in that, it'll flag it so that you can go out and hand check it to see if you're getting electrolysis or other things, features that are eating away at the base of the rail. But this is one area, which I'll turn over to Joe, because do you want to add anything to that?
No, it's fine.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
I just want to point this out to everyone that you can layer in all these layers of defenses. If you get something along the bottom of the rail or some other crack, that is not detectable with all the technology in the world. So I just want to caution that that's put out there.
Thanks, Pat.
Mr. Dorsey.
Thank you. So you mentioned that the uplink and downlink scanning that you did was comprehensive after the fact. Is there a reason in terms of cost, expense, or time why the standard operating procedures for the regular testing of that was sort of not followed?
Yeah, I have to do more analysis on that, but my initial sense is it's practical drift. But they were relying on end users to tell you when there's a problem. There's 42,000 transmissions a day. So I think they had this sense of assurance that we had a pretty good system in place. But myself and Joe want a regimented, formalized approach to doing that activity.
But there are no resource constraints that should allow that to drift. It's just the way it kind of
I have to examine that more, and that's part of what we'll look at to see if it's properly resourced. And we are bringing on outside party to do it to make sure that we don't have that issue.
One of the issues is there's no industry standard when it comes to the public safety radio. How often do you test it? Same thing with an internal radio. So as the third party comes in and begins weekly, we're going to be looking at data to see how often do things fail and try and come up with what is the appropriate frequency that we move forward with.
And a second question, if I may, Mr. Lobby. So the rail that was procured in 93, have we identified all of the other areas where rail was procured at the same time from the same source to determine whether those merit further inspection, or are we going to wait for the metallurgical testing to tell us what to do next?
I believe we're going to wait for the metallurgical testing. I've been doing this a long time. It's very, very rare. I mean, it does occur, but generally it's not a rail manufacturing defect. And if it was, I don't believe from 93 to present, it's something would have manifested itself much sooner.
I just like to say a brief comment. I think, Metro employees really need to be commended for the work in taking what is a relatively unusual circumstance, even though it's not uncommon and unheard of, and really prioritizing getting people out safely, even though we would have certainly preferred to see that it happen a little bit more quickly. I'm thrilled that it happened in such a way that we could really have a very orderly flow and taking care of passengers. So good job to you all for the work that you've done and to the employees on the front line who performed it.
Thank you.
Mr. Orner?
Thanks. I have no questions. I just want to compliment you on a first-rate presentation. You clearly have the situation in hand.
Thank you.
Mr. Evans.
Yeah, thank you very much. And first of all, thank you all for a very, very comprehensive presentation today. And when this first happened, there were really three issues that were raised immediately. Number one was, how could this happen? After all the work we've done, SafeTrack, et cetera, how did this happen? And I think you've adequately addressed the fact this was not a SafeTrack area. SafeTrack wasn't here, would not have prevented this from happening, and even the ongoing maintenance that we've been doing would not have prevented this from happening. So we really don't know what caused this, and in whatever time period there is, we will find out at some point more information that helps us understand the cause of this. The second issue that came up immediately was communications. How, after all this time, would we have communication problems? And again, I think you've spelled out why that was, what we're doing to address that to make sure that communications are even better in the future. And then the third issue is, why did it take so long to get everybody off of the trains? And I had an opportunity to meet with Chief Dean, who is the fire chief in the District of Columbia, chief of the fire and EMS, spent over an hour with him and walked through the procedure from the moment it happened till the last passenger was off the train and on the platform. And as he stressed to me, as you have as well, the passenger safety was the overall overriding approach. And that if circumstances were different and we had to get people off a lot faster, we would have. But once it was determined that there was no danger, that passengers were safe and in a secure area, that we took the method that was the safest for the passengers. Even though we explored the idea of another train, that it became apparent that walking people off was the safest way, that there were plenty of personnel there, and that we got everybody off safely. And so I'm satisfied at this point in time that this was, that we've learned our lessons. One thing I wanted to point out, and you may have mentioned this, I'm not sure, that we do have a fire representative, fire and EMS representative at the ROC at all times. And so, unlike in the past, the coordinated effort between Metro and the various different fire departments around the region is ongoing and is very, very, and works very well. And as the chief stressed with me, that this was really a coordinated effort between fire and EMS and Metro that worked quite well. And so, again, I was pleased to hear that that happened, and that even though an hour and a half may have transpired, that that was something in their training that they would expect to happen in a situation like this. So I'll ask you if you have any further comments on that, but those were the three areas that I think were most prevalent in the public when this first happened.
I'd just like to add your comment about the coordination. The ROC liaison that was on duty was from Montgomery County, and you had an incident in D.C. So it goes to show you how well our drills, or the drills that we do with different jurisdictions, and how that coordination and work has transpired over the last couple of years. I just want to put a word out. It's very good job.
Okay, and I'd just like to add my voice to the others that good job. Metro really, I think, showed itself well, and the surrounding jurisdictions showed themselves well in what could have been a difficult situation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, everyone. Do we have any other questions?
I don't have a question. I want to endorse the commendation of Member Horner. Your presentation was very comprehensive, and I must say, since I was here for the L'Enfant Plaza incident, that it was a much more comprehensive presentation that board members received today than they received at that point, and staff, and you should be commended for it. But as in that incident, that's only the first step. We have to get your report in 90 or 120 days, and then we have to examine it and determine as board members what we need to do to make sure that incidents like this don't happen, because I think as board members, our primary obligation is the safety of the riders. We have to make sure that we as board members are doing all we can to assure that they're on a safe ride, and that when there are incidents and problems, that their lives and their extraction from the vehicles is our highest priority of staff. Thank you.
I do have one more question. I'd like to ask a little bit, if you could explain a little bit how the notification is accomplished in an emergency, especially in a case where maybe the operator is not able to respond, or radio issues or other things. Does anything happen automatically, or is this a decision that's made at the ROC as far as notifying the fire department that you have an emergency?
So you do have the ROC liaison in Iraq, so they would be aware in real time of any situations that were occurring. And it's kind of a broad question, but typically if you have a train that's not responding, you would immediately dispatch supervision to the scene. They would assess it. If there was any inkling of anything beyond that, then I'm sure that we would dispatch emergency service personnel, whether it's police, fire, or internal resources.
Is that initial decision made by the control center to call emergency services?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. If there's no other questions, this meeting stands adjourned.